You're listening to the programme Saskia Unreserved on RIC Classic.
A very warm welcome to Mike Truesdell and Mike Compitella, the Mic Drop Percussion Duo, who are going to be performing tonight as the closing concert of the 15th International Pharos Contemporary Music Festival. Thank you both so much for being here.
Oh,
after a busy morning, stimulating over 100 music, not only music students, students of in Cyprus. That's wonderful.
Yes.
To hear.
Oh, it was such a joy. We had an absolute wonderful time with them.
Going back to quite a few years ago, how did you meet one another?
I met Mike Truesdell when he auditioned for the graduate school I was attending. I was a student at the Yale School of Music, and Mike came to audition. And at that point, my student job was to monitor the audition. So I met him at his audition, which was just phenomenal. and we sort of had parallel lives, you know, different schools, but kind of similar experience. And then at some point, I was living and working in Kansas, and Mike was living and working in Colorado. And we thought, okay, we're pretty close by
American standards. I'm so glad
you
added that.
We're pretty close. We should try to play a concert together. And so we did, and it turned out we have a lot in common. But we started with just pressurized meeting.
Ethos, yes. Yeah. What is it that led you both to become percussionists?
Well,
Did you have similar roots?
I feel like we had similar roots to someone who's a maybe non-musician would recognize this as similar roots. But for us, there's these different streams in percussion. Like there's people who get into percussion from a piano background, and there's people who get into percussion from a drum set background. And for us, they're relatively the same, but those are two different approaches.
Mm.
And I came from a piano background and Mike came from a drum set background. And I think that's one of the greatest parts is that we have this complementary strengths.
Yes. Getting into an orchestra is tough anyway, but for a percussionist, the challenge is just phenomenal, simply because there's only one usually, or two, let's say three in Chicago Symphony or whatever, bigger orchestras. What do you think are the greatest challenges for those who are doing auditions?
Wow. Well, I know Mike Truesdell probably has more experience with this than I do, but at least in the United States, the challenges are that there are so many people that are auditioning. There are usually so few jobs. And in the U.S., we do our auditions blind. So there's a screen, and the people that are judging don't see the person playing.
That's both good and bad, isn't it?
It can be both, yeah.
Yeah, it has fundamentally altered the gender balance of orchestras.
Okay.
It's really empowered gender equity in American orchestras. But on the other hand, as a performer, it's very nerve-wracking. And so I would say the challenges are...
You mean not to be seen?
Yes, exactly. And the challenges are really that the percussion orchestral repertoire, compared to maybe a violin audition, the excerpts that you play are very short, and they're almost like doing a calisthenics, you know, a single jumping jack or a single sit-up. Yeah. And so it's very easy to make a mistake, or it's very easy to slip up in some way. So it's a very pressurized situation.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Totally agree. And I might add, too, that like percussion as a whole, we talk about the difference between depth and breadth in percussion. So you could specialize in one instrument, and sometimes somebody might be a marimba player.
Yes.
And that's all they do, and the marimba is their instrument, and that's how they express themselves. And then there's other people for whom breadth is like their defining feature. So they can play, like you're talking about with orchestras,
yes,
they can play timpani and snare drum and bass drum and cymbals and triangle and tambourine and then castanets, and they have to play all these other instruments. So sometimes that's a really difficult part for a percussionist, is that we're not going to play our 10 excerpts, let's say, on one instrument. It's going to be 10 excerpts on xylophone, 10 excerpts on timpani, 10 excerpts on bass drum, and that's difficult.
So if you get to the xylophone and you have Appalachian spring in front of you.
It can be terrifying.
It's
a different technique than playing the snare drum.
Oh, I was thinking concerto for orchestra.
Exactly, sure. Yeah.
Bolero.
You know
that
it.
That is really hard work.
Sure. Rimsky-Korsakov Scheherazade is a difficult excerpt for snare drum.
The preparation, do you think that this is done through one's degree and musical training so that you cover many instruments?
Good question. I think there are a lot of different ways of approaching it. My training was more broad, where I was studying many different instruments in the classical tradition, and other people maybe will only study orchestral music in their degree. But whether it's achieved through the degree, not necessarily. I think now in 2024, it's never been easier to find a teacher and work with a teacher. But I think for the most people our age and older, the vast majority of your training was sort of accomplished in school, because that's the time of your life you have the most time. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree that in university training, one of the most difficult things for percussionists is time management. So I find, as a teacher myself, I try to put my students in situations where they have to manage their time well.
Right.
Because I think that's probably one of the most important skills. Like, I could go out and play tambourine really well, or play a concert really well even, but managing my time, showing up to the place on time, being early to set up instruments and move things, and just being organized in thought is probably one of the most important skills we have.
Mm. Mm. Do you think that the instruments that one chooses is also part of your musical personality?
Oh, definitely. Mm. Yeah, and it helps. Like, I think it's a reciprocal relationship, that you are choosing an instrument and sometimes the instrument chooses you, right?
Yes.
Like, so you play something and you realize, oh my gosh, I'm getting a great energy from this instrument. Mm. So I want to pursue more of that.
Yeah. How often have you come across timpanists who are actually playing the percussion instruments as well? Isn't that usually just the timpanist is the timpanist of the orchestra?
I think you would be surprised, although in their job description they only play timpani. Many timpanists are great percussionists as well.
Yes.
But maybe they're not allowed to play percussion with the orchestra. In your experience?
Yeah, definitely. Yes. And it's a very different approach too, because timpanists are usually concerned with a little different technique that has to do with sound and articulation, and they're playing a lot of repertoire that percussionists don't get to play.
Like, yes.
You play a Beethoven symphony, and until the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven, there's no percussion parts. So you have a different approach. And so when you're transitioning over, moving over a chair, let's say, and playing a percussion instrument, you're approaching it with a different outlook than another percussionist might.
Yes. Mm. And of course, there's the tuning aspect of
Yeah. One of the great
challenges. I always find, yes, that's a massive challenge within a sound, to, you know, one little tap with your finger and you've got to be able to hear it.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
Handling stress during auditions and generally, we mentioned Ravel's Bolero, can really take it out of you. How do you sustain the stamina that's needed?
Well, that I think is part of the school training. It's almost like going to a, like, I'm going to say this with hesitation, but like a military boot camp, right? When you go to a school where you want to play and you want to have opportunities to play in pressure situations with other students. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times we're asking other students to come listen to us, and you might play an entire 2 hours of orchestral excerpts that are like Mike was saying, like a few seconds a piece, but you're playing for several hours for like a really critical audience. And then, you know, you go through these things with fellow, colleagues in school, but then, you know, there's a big moment when you go play for your teacher, and that teacher, it increases the stress even more. And so you're kind of conditioning yourself to play in stressful situations, which may sound bad in the moment, but really helps you when it's time for that audition.
Mm. Mm. Handling rejection, is that something that you actually teach your students? Because it must be so disheartening, audition after audition, and they go through an awful lot of rejections before they get the job. I mean, even if it's simply numbers. And we all know that there's a certain amount of nepotism as well within the orchestral world. Everybody knows. So, you know, when you said we play behind screens, we always knew who was actually behind the screen, especially, when it was from within the ranks of the orchestra and someone was standing. We knew that that was that person or that was that person.
With my own students, definitely. And I know maybe Mike has a different experience. I teach at a university, Arizona State University, in Tempe, Arizona. And yeah, rejection is a major part of, you know, the training, be it an orchestral audition or an application for something, or even just maybe not playing to the level that you want. The best way I've found to work with students on it is to, of course, feel bad. But if you focus perhaps on not necessarily competing with others, but trying to articulate the best version of your own plan, how you were going to do it, you're really only focused on yourself.
Right.
And at a certain point, if the people on the audition committee or on the scholarship committee decide that you're not the one for them, hopefully it's just a matter of taste. And so you try to train your students or to work with them to be as absolutely prepared as they can be with their own plan. And then if it doesn't go according to plan, you have data and information you can adjust for the next time. Mm. But it can be really disheartening to put so much pressure on yourself for one small event. But I don't know.
Yeah,
how
I
do
think
you
there's something that I, when I was growing up, I started as a violin player. Well, I started out with Suzuki violin,
right,
and I moved through piano lessons into percussion lessons. And one of the really tricky things about going through the music education is that we're taught that music is not what you do, but who you are, and that was pressed upon us for a long time. And it's something that's almost a calling more than a job. And so that feels really great because I feel a lot of motivation to be a musician. But when you get that rejection, it's different than getting a rejection from a job interview because now you're rejecting me and not my plan.
Yes.
So that's really difficult.
Mm.
So I think that I had to come to grips with that, 10 years ago or so, with the fact that I can separate myself from this craft, but I can also be invested in the craft.
Mm.
Yeah. And I think that was important for me to have that relationship with failure, which is a really critical part of growth.
Yeah, and I think for people our age, our training was very much, you know, a critique of your performance was a critique of you as a person. And what's inspiring about the generation of students I'm working with now is that it's not necessarily true. So we can help create a mindset of working on your craft and not have it be a critique of you as a human, which is very difficult to do because it's so embedded in our training.
What other alternatives are there? And do you discuss those with your students about what they can do with their music? That there's maybe a library option. I think probably everyone's, you know, putting their hands over their head after being practicing a musician. You don't really think of going in that direction, but it can be fulfilling. I'm sitting behind the microphone now after so many years in an orchestra. It's different, but it's possible.
From my standpoint, because I teach at a public university, my mission is to help my students become better humans first, and then become better musicians, and then maybe become better at their instrument, in this case, percussion. So studying music, at least at a university, is a degree in the humanities. So my hope is that study will give you skills. It'll give you skills of collaboration, of doing something really difficult alone, that are extremely valuable whatever career path you follow. And unfortunately,
I'm so glad that you've said that because it's so, so important.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I've noticed is that people in other fields love hiring people with music backgrounds because you can bet that person is used to failure, is used to spending a long time on something, can probably interact with other people or maybe do something really difficult alone for a long period
of
time.
And if I can add, too, like I think something that musicians are uniquely skilled at is being able to teach themselves anything.
Yes.
Because we have to interpret these almost hieroglyphic notes from a composer and interpret and dig deep into a historical context and an artistic context. And then we have to create and teach ourselves how this piece goes and then create it for an audience. So I found that a lot of my colleagues, like I agree with exactly what you were saying, that there's a lot of different opportunities in music that aren't playing in an orchestra, even though that's wonderful, or teaching in a university like we do. There's administrative, artistic administrative jobs. There's the library jobs. There's like different kinds of supportive roles. There's, you know, starting artistic foundations. There's a whole bunch of different opportunities. But then
I think we're sort of taught that it's all or nothing. But in reality, the way you engage with music, it's however you choose. You know, our training is either I'm fully musician or zero. But actually, you can...
You can encompass other fields and other spheres.
Definitely.
And of course, I think it also makes one a better rounded musician when you have other interests as well.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
And it's not only that you think about music or even that you listen to one type of music.
Definitely. I think Mike C. Compitello is probably the most well-rounded like thinker that I know. I mean, he's somebody who's constantly interested in non-musical things, but it all informs each other.
Yes.
I guess my thought is, if the only thing you can do is speak your instrument, who are you going to speak it to and what are you going to speak about? And we're lucky as artists that we can live in our contemporary societies and we can engage with people. And if you have chosen not to engage, that's kind of a wasted opportunity. So having, you know, first of all, just your audience is people that are not percussionists, or you might want to engage, you know, with a social cause, and just being able to speak with other people is so phenomenal. At least in the U.S. in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a pretty big culture shift in terms of people who are studying in the arts trying to bring all of their influences to them instead of saying, I'm only going to talk about percussion with you, but what are all the other things that you can do? And I think that's been very healthy.
Yes. I always think of musicians as part of a multidisciplinary team. They can be so helpful, for example, in the business sphere, because there are so many things that are aligned. And one of the first things that comes to mind is discipline. Musicians have to be incredibly disciplined, especially as far as practicing is concerned. And I've heard many people say, oh, what on earth do you think? This is a triangle. You just bang it and it makes a sound. Now, anyone who's tried a trill, it's not easy.
It's also very intimidating in an orchestra to stand up with the triangle knowing everybody is going to notice
exactly
what I'm about to do.
Talk to us about that part of it, this mental discipline, preparation, and how many hours do you think should be spent practicing, especially for a percussionist where you said there were these time constraints? So do you spend it on marimba?
Right.
How do you go about it?
I couldn't agree with what you said more. That's a wonderful way of saying it. And the triangle is a great example of an instrument that seems really simple. I mean, the name of the triangle is the shape of the instrument. Like,
pretty easy, yeah.
It's like calling a clarinet a line.
Yeah.
So the triangle takes a lot of time because you're not only learning how to strike the instrument, but also you have to figure out what makes a good sound on a triangle. And that comes from a lot of research of listening and working closely with another person. And then also there's experimentation with the instrument itself and coming up with your own tastes and your own views. So I think part of that is just the re-engineering of the sound yourself to make your own voice. But as far as like how to disperse your sound or your time to encompass all of these instruments, it's a really difficult thing. And a lot of times it requires us to practice without an instrument. Like, you know, Mike and I traveled over here from the U.S. and we didn't touch our instruments for maybe 3 or 4 days before we got here, because, and we're going to be playing on an instrument that we've never seen before.
I was going to ask about that. Tell us. It's challenging.
Yeah, so a lot of our practice actually is in our heads, where we, you know, we'll sit on the plane and we'll close our eyes and we'll see the xylophone in front of us.
Yes.
And we can see the notes go by, and that actually helps us adapt to these different instruments. Yeah. It's like a pianist in a way.
You need to look for ways of practicing one instrument that can transfer to another instrument.
Right.
And so hopefully over time you can do that, but it is difficult at first, I think. Mm.
You also need to organize your sticks and your mallets. And I wanted to say, ask about how you acquire as a student your instruments. Do you stay at the university before you get to university level? Say you're 16, 17. In order to get into university, you've got to be practicing. So what happens there? Do parents need to fork out?
This is a great question, and I think it's sort of a defining theme of music education in the U.S. right now, the way in which socioeconomic differences can change your life over a long period of time.
Absolutely.
You know, even considering the cost of college. But for most, at least in the U.S., most people that are going to want to go to college for percussion will probably have some access to instruments at their high school, and so they might be able to practice there. They might have a private teacher. Maybe they rent some little things. But I would say that the majority of people would you know, rely on an institution in some way.
And are those institutions, the universities, fully equipped with the best equipment? I mean, if you're not at Curtis, if you're not at Yale, Juilliard?
It varies for sure. Like, some places are definitely have better instruments than others, or spaces that are more conducive to private study. And there's high schools, like the, you know, people who are 15, 16 years old who are starting to think about music school, they'll probably be in a band or orchestra program that has some instruments, or they might know a person or have a private teacher that has instruments. And a lot of the students that I work with now at Ithaca College were people who, like, would go over to their teacher's house and practice at nights after the teacher was done teaching. Or they would go into the high school on the weekend and they would
practice. Love to see that in Cyprus. Students arriving at the teacher's house to practice.
Yeah. I know I did that
as well.
It depends
on the teacher.
Yeah.
Right.
No, it's difficult with percussion because you need to solve that conundrum of instruments. And
yes.
How did you practice timpani?
Yeah, I was good.
Sorry.
Good.
I don't mean to ask the questions.
One thing that sometimes Mike and I talk about is that in classical percussion, the sort of success stories for us are unicorns. There are exceptions to the rule.
Yes.
You know, so for me, I started playing because my parents were teaching at a university, and the university was offering free music lessons to children of professors. So I started, and then when I moved, my parents moved to a different university, same thing. My teacher said, you need to audition for this thing, and I'm going to lend you timpani. And so I remember I rented a minivan and I drove them home. And so for a month I just camped out, and of course my parents were so patient to hear just this.
Are they
ferocious
musicians?
They're not musicians.
Oh, okay, that can be challenging then.
Yeah, I think they were academics, so they understand spending a long time on something without showing any signs of improvement.
Yes.
So I think it's, unfortunately, you know, in the U.S., because of how our education system works, you rely on a private teacher and maybe the kindness of the teacher. I know I teach at a university, and it's my mission to open up the school to younger students that need a place to practice.
Right.
And so I will tell, well, if you need to come play this instrument that you don't own, You can do it here,
yes.
But it's challenging. Yeah.
What about mallets? These are something that you definitely need to have. Do you teach your students to make their own, to repair them?
Ooh, I know I was taught to repair my own mallets, particularly timpani mallets.
Yep, you definitely want to have that skill.
Yeah.
It saves you some money in the long run, and you can craft your own sound.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, I think you... you probably will save up and get your own sticks and mallets. I know that I have a few like specialty mallets and sticks that I don't expect the students to own. And if I need to lend out some of my own mallets, that's totally fine. But it helps the students like kind of get some traction so that they can maybe eventually get their own mallets.
Which ones would you recommend? I mean, I see that they were felt, they were bamboo.
The
balance is quite different within the sticks. So how does one find the balance?
Okay,
we talk about this.
We talk about this quite a bit. Mike and I, our hobby is that we have a podcast.
Yes.
And we talk sometimes
about this.
They're
fabulous.
I recommend them very highly.
Yes.
But I think sometimes sticks and mallets are sort of like shoes. The same shoe will fit differently on two different people. And so it depends on sort of how you play. But maybe you know the feeling too with a bow. When somebody gives you a bow to try, it
yes.
might change how you play. It's a different
yes.
outfit. And so I, with my students, I let them try many of my sticks and mallets. And then, of course, I have my preferences. And so when I teach, my sound is a certain way. And so sometimes students will try to imitate you at least until they can do something else better. But I don't know.
And if they're lucky enough, like, or and they maybe save up a bunch of money, or they get a financial support from somewhere, they can go to this thing called the Percussive Arts Society International Convention.
Wow.
Which is held in Indianapolis, Indiana, U.S. every year. And it's a place where, a lot of people come from all over the world and present topics, and they do master classes. But there's also companies that come.
Yes.
And they display their sticks and mallets and instruments. So, some students can go into this big open area where everyone's playing instruments and things, and they can try out as so many different kinds of sticks and mallets. And you could even, try to go to a music store and do the same thing in your local town. But
I would say percussionists are hoarders. We collect things, and we don't easily get rid of things.
Right.
We were just talking last night with a percussionist here in town about the rain stick and about how he wanted this one particular sound, but
yes.
he needed to get another one and then another one and then another one.
Yes.
And so we have no trouble accumulating
because
things.
Musicians never reach perfection.
No, of course not.
It's always, there's that elusive factor,
yep.
I think, which makes one just, it keeps one moving forward
yeah.
in a way, doesn't it? It's physically demanding. Being a musician, how do you stay in shape, both physically and mentally?
I would say Mike T is probably more mentally in shape than I am. Mike has incredible routines. He regiments his life in a really powerful way.
And, sure,
but I'm more laissez-faire as a as a human. I think physically, taking care of yourself, especially when you get slightly older,
yes.
is nice. But I know Mike has a sort of daily regimen.
It kind of changes, but I feel like there's a physical and a mental component to like a morning routine that I find very helpful, that I want to do some exercise every day, and I try to alternate what that is so my body can stay strong. But, weight training or cardio exercise, things to help us like just move these instruments. And then also, like you were saying, like we have to play instruments that are very physical. They're long, they're tall, they're heavy. Mm. So you want to be in some kind of physical shape in order to do that. And then something about routine for me that's really helpful is if I can get myself into a routine, not to be rigid and to block out other things, but actually so that I don't have to worry about that anymore. Like my brain and my body is used to getting up and first thing exercising physically and doing some meditation so that I can get my mind in a good place And the routine actually helps free me up to think about other things.
Do you have muscle memory involved in playing the marimba? And I'm thinking especially when you have 2, 3, do you even have 4 sticks that you hold at the same time?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'd always find that absolutely phenomenal.
Well, percussionists, like string players, rely a lot on muscle memory. We rely on muscle memory and visual memory. Sonic memory. And a lot of times muscle memory, though, can be very faulty when you get nervous.
Yes.
And so we do rely heavily on muscle memory as we're learning, as we're playing, because unlike other instruments, we don't touch our instrument.
Yes.
So it's there's a lot more sort of muscle there.
Sure.
Yeah.
But also what you said about visual memory, like we have the unique ability, I guess, to see what we're playing, as opposed to, you know, violinists can look a little bit, but really you're relying a lot on the feel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, pianists can see their notes a little bit, but really they have such an instrument that you can't see the outer edges. Mm-hmm. But we can. So actually visual memory when we're playing a marimba or xylophone is actually really important, which is why when we do our mental practice, like we kind of see the instrument and play the notes, or they light up maybe for some people.
Are there students whom you've come across, probably not now that you're at a tertiary level, but those who are at the very beginning, who are starting to, or who want to play, that they lack the coordination and motor skills? Is that something that can be learned, or is that something that has to be really inherent? And a sense of rhythm as well. Oh, I was thinking that too.
I think
too.
It can be, fundamentally, it can be learned. And my reasoning is that for pitch and for language, there's a period of your life where you're much more flexible at learning a language. And for most people, their body undergoes a fundamental change at some point where different muscles form. And I do think it is possible, because in that transition period or even after, it's very easy to train your nervous system to do a new physical action. It's more difficult to train your ear, I think, to become acquainted with a pitch or become acquainted with a language. But I think the physical training is probably the easiest part.
Definitely.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. As you're a younger person too, like you're generally not as coordinated. And sometimes that's to your benefit. Like you can do things that it would take Mike and I a month to learn, but you could just do it right now because your limbs aren't talking to each other in the same way.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes it could be a benefit and not only a detriment, but yeah, I agree that it's a matter of kind of like seeing somebody do it usually is one of the more inspiring things. Like if you see somebody play an instrument, or if you see an orchestra play and all of the string players are changing their bows together, that has an impact on people that they realize, I can do that. That's a real person down there doing that. Mm. And I am a real person. I can do that too, but I just need to work at it. And sometimes we need that click.
Repertoire. You've got an extraordinary program that you're going to be performing tonight, starting from Scarlatti. Well, not starting, but including Scarlatti, yeah, but the range is huge, right to contemporary music. Do you find that there's enough repertoire that is not only transcriptions, original music written for, from castanets to triangles to we've said marimbas, xylophones?
I do, and one thing that's great about being a percussionist is that we have a really active hand in the future of our instrument, because there's not a lot of repertoire before certain years. And one thing we can do is we can work with composers on new pieces. Mm. We can curate concerts. We can really take action in a way that can help develop our instrument. So are there enough pieces? Probably not, but
definitely not. Please keep writing music for percussion.
Yes.
If you're a composer out there. And we were also just saying recently that the art form that we are playing tonight and the art form of solo percussion music is something that's happened really in recent time. So like really one of the founding fathers of percussion in the contemporary realm, like the maybe non-orchestral but more solo or chamber music, contemporary music, that one of the founding fathers of that art form actually just passed away last year. And the first like composed piece for percussion solo is actually younger than my parents. Wow. So the art form that we, you know, encompass maybe half of the year and we perform on stage, that art form is younger than my parents. Yeah. And I know that they would hate me saying that. So I'm sorry, Mom and Dad. But just to put it in perspective, it's quite a young art form.
Yes.
And
which gives us less pressure to some extent, because we don't have that pressure that a pianist does in terms of repertoire.
Yes.
And we're very often judged as much by what we play as how we play it.
But on the other side, I think that there's this almost like imposter syndrome or jealousy that we feel sometimes as percussionists, because I love that keyboard repertoire. And like the Scarlatti, the Pogorelich recording that you had just played is, you know, I love Pogorelich and I love his story about the Chopin competition, and I love the recordings of the Scarlatti and everything that he's done. And so I want to be a part of that, which has led us to play some of these earlier pieces, because we want to have our fingers on these notes and these mallets, and we want to be making these sounds and giving our own stamp on these pieces that are hundreds of years old.
But so, then we also moved to lots of Cyprus premieres, including the artistic director of the festival, Evis Samoudis, too.
Absolutely. So I had.
Did you have an opportunity to work with one another prior to this?
Luckily enough, yes. We Evis was actually a colleague of mine I met at Ithaca College, where I teach now.
Oh.
And Evis was a professor there.
Yes.
Yep. And he's recently moved to the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, just an hour and a half north of Ithaca there. But so I've had the wonderful privilege of knowing Evis both on a personal and professional level for a few years now. And when the opportunity came up to play this this duo of his, we jumped at it. And what is so engaging about Evis's music is this like cornucopia of sound that he's able to create out of just one drum. He can use the different areas of the drum to create different sounds, and he can use both the top and the bottom of the drum and different sticks that we're holding, and just the way that we interact is so powerful. So we're, you know, at the very beginning, it's kind of difficult to get into a new piece, because every piece has its own world that you have to enter into, and you have to meet all the people in that world.
Do you present to them what you're going to play as well, or are you reliant on the very substantive program notes from Yvonne?
I have a very strong opinion about this as a performer, which is that it's such a joy to share music with somebody that they've never heard before. And the opportunity to invite people in is so powerful. So for those of us in contemporary music, to be able to say not what you should hear, because sometimes then people will say, I didn't hear that, I didn't hear that. But to say, well, this music is sort of coming from this place.
Yes.
I invite you to hear something in it. That is, for me, so powerful that if it were I in charge, I would do that for every piece of music, because the closing the door for people and saying, you know, you don't understand this, or that's
or
so
creating a distance rather, you know, than a closeness.
And especially in the world we're in of contemporary music, there's so many different ways of creating sound. You could spend the entire piece of music trying to discover how to listen to that piece of music. And so 10 minutes later you think, oh, the rhythm is the important thing.
Yes.
And that's so challenging. So the opportunity to invite people in and to invite people to have an opinion, even if whatever that opinion is, I think can be very valuable. I'm going to step down from my soapbox now.
So just to speak about the program tonight, the way we put the pieces together, we're hoping to invite a narrative of the concert. So we're feeling like this concert is a lot like the relationship we're going to have with our audience, that we started off in two different places. And it's basically about two people meeting, having experiences together, really bonding in a moment. And then we're going to slowly drift apart and go our separate ways, hoping to meet again. And so we're structuring the pieces and the even the way we're playing certain pieces, and also the way we're spatializing instruments in our amazing space,
right,
to kind of support that narrative. And like Mike was saying, one of the most powerful things is that somebody can come with their own experience and transplant themselves into this narrative that we're creating, and that's going to be a totally unique experience for a single audience member.
But also, one wonderful thing about the Shoe Factory is that so much of that work is done for you as a performer, because you are so close to the performer. There's not this stage that's 10 feet tall.
It's a very special space.
And that, for me, is the joy of playing music, is not necessarily me telling you something, but creating this moment where we are all in this place together. And that, I think, is the magic of music. And so speaking to people about the program, great, but also just being close.
Yeah.
Feeling that energy, that I think is something that the venue for this evening's performance certainly does, and we're excited to
share.
Well,
it's been wonderful to have you here on the program. Thank you so much for coming. Wishing you everything of the best for tonight. Mike Drusdell and Mike Compitello from Mike Drop, as the T-shirt says.